Today we launch our series on constitutionalism in Latin America, and we couldn't be more fortunate than having as our first speaker an historian of great distinction and reputation in the field. Kenneth Maxwell was born in the United Kingdom in Somerset. He was educated at St. John's College at Cambridge. He came to this country initially as a visiting scholar at the Newbery Library, and then became professor at the University of Kansas at Lawrence, and then for 5 years was a scholar at the Institute of Advanced Studies in Princeton, maybe the premier research center in the humanities and sciences in the world. One of his friends and mentors was Felix Gilbert, and sometime if you want to read classic writings on political thought, why he certainly has contributed as many quality pieces as anybody that I know. Then Kenneth Maxwell became professor of history at Columbia University, and soon thereafter a program director at the Tinker Foundation, whose leader is a remarkable woman that some of us came to know in New York, Martha Muse, who was a one-man, one-woman leader for quite a while, but then attracted Kenneth and several others, I think staff people now, but still is one of the most respected people in philanthropy, I think, anywhere that I know. The next appointment that Dr. Maxwell had was at the Camos Center, Center for Portuguese and Spanish Studies at Columbia. And now most recently he's become the senior fellow and head of the Latin American program at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. One of the interesting things is that the Council on Foreign Relations is, by its location and by its reputation, supposed to solve all the problems of the world instantaneously, and some of the previous work had concentrated entirely on what to do about the Contras. Kenneth Maxwell has brought a considerably broader perspective to Latin American studies, and around the country, if not the world, people are looking forward to a new period of excellence at the Council in the Latin American field. His writings are numerous, continue to come out, and are distinguished perhaps even more by their quality. His best-known work is a book called Conflicts and Conspiracies, Brazil and Portuguese, 1750 to 1808, a study of the 18th and 19th century Brazilian independence movement. I don't know whether he covers your area or not, but maybe you can probe that in the question period. Published by Cambridge University Press. And more recently, he has discussed democratization in Portugal and Spain. I think this Latin American part of our constitutionalism series could be one of the most interesting and most of most lasting value, because as the Soviet and East European experience has taught us, now belatedly people are beginning to recognize that institutions and political organization of a country is vital to its life, to its growth and its reputation, and to its experiences of the people who live under these regimes. Great changes are underway, and it's very possible, it seems to me, we could learn things from a Latin American inquiry that would throw light on experiences that are going on elsewhere. In any case, this is our kickoff discussion. It will delve into earlier historical periods and lay a foundation for anything that is to follow in our discussions of Latin American institutions.
Well, Kenneth, thanks very much indeed. It's an enormous thrill to be here at the University of Virginia for reasons you'll, I think, discover in the course of what I have to say, the special reasons why I'm very excited to for this invitation. And when Ken first called me, I think the idea was mainly to talk about some contemporary issues, but I said to him, well, I haven't been working 25 years on the historical aspects. And it's very curious, I think, as you, some of you know, working in this type of area, that it's like a jigsaw puzzle, in that it probably takes 30, 40, 50 years maybe until you get all the pieces together, and you sometimes discover little bits that fit together. And some of the bits that are beginning to fit together, I'll try and lay out this morning. So if some of this seems a little disjointed, it's disjointed partly because it's an incomplete process that I'm going through in looking at what one might call the origins of constitutionalism in Latin America, looking in terms of period mainly at the late 18th century, early 19th century. So I will be talking mainly within that period this morning. Also, I think you can't talk about everything. It's a mistake to try and talk about everything. So the part of my Latin America will be somewhat defined or constrained. I'm thinking about Atlantic America, what I call Atlantic America. That is really the circum-Atlantic aspects of the civilization of the late 18th century, which were given, I think, in a great two-volume work some 20 years ago, some form by Robert Palmer in his famous book, The Age of Democratic Revolution, where he very much talked about an Atlantic revolution, a democratic revolution of the late 18th century. So I'll be talking a little bit about the relationships across the Atlantic, from North America to Europe, and across the South Atlantic, focusing to some degree on Brazil. And I hope some of the elements that might come out of this for the rest of Latin America we could discuss after the presentation. I think these are the areas which are perhaps least known, so that's another justification, I think, for examining them. And they're also areas which have a very specific linkage to Charlottesville, as you'll hear, and to Thomas Jefferson. But how I'd like to organize this is to begin with some general observations, which I think might be useful to the general inquiry that you'll be undertaking on Latin American constitutionalism, then to look fairly specifically at what I would call the sort of tissue of relationships that existed in this period, which are not theoretical. I'm not talking in a speculative way. I want to talk very specifically in the second section about people, about ideas, about the impact of ideas on institutional forms, particularly in Brazil. And then the third part will be to look at a rather fascinating link, as I say, to Virginia, and then finally to try and sum up the general observations again on the basis of those specific comments. I think looking at this whole period, one of the key questions really that's been in the back of the mind of historians and lawyers and constitutional experts looking at North America as opposed to South America is why certain institutional forms take hold in some areas and not in others. I mean, that is why, the big question, I suppose, is why one has a constitutional settlement in the 1770s through the 1780s in what became the United States, which held, which still holds, which provided the institutional setting for an enormous expansion territorially, but for a very successful growth, growth of power, growth of wealth, growth of liberty. And when one looks at South America, why similar types of structures did not take hold. I suppose this is, as I say, is the sort of big question that one has. And there have been really two approaches, it seems to me, over the last 20 or 30 years in looking at this. One's had the one I mentioned at the beginning, the Palmer notion of a democratic revolution of the 18th century, an Atlantic-wide phenomenon. I think one could look at this as a sort of linear interpretive framework that saw the Enlightenment leading to a process of liberalization, of the emphasis on individual liberties. One had the formation of this into a doctrine of constitutionalism, which emphasized individual rights, types of rights that one has in the Bill of Rights, and were enshrined, of course, in some of the state constitutions. In other words, one had the whole notion summed up, I think, by a state of law and not of men. I mean, the one we've heard a lot of in recent times in the variety of scandals and so on that are being investigated by Congress. That is, law, a state of law and not of men, seems to me to sum up that that paradigm. It's basically an optimistic paradigm. It's, as I say, I think a linear view. It sees cause and effect, and it, as I say, I think it's summed up in the works very much of Palmer. Though there is a famous French historian, Jacques Godeschaux, who also represents this line of argument. The counter, and I'm being very schematic, obviously, and very simplistic in what I'm saying, but essentially the other line, I think, would be called more economistic interpretation, Marxist to some degree, but not entirely, because on certain elements, classical liberal theory also agrees with this interpretation. That is, that sees essentially what's happening in the late 18th century, early 19th century, as a systemic crisis, in a Marxist sense, from feudalism to bourgeoisie in the sort of crude sense, but also from commercial capitalism, mercantilism, break out of that into a more liberal, free trade type of world economic situation. In other words, what this does is place something like the American Revolution, not in a revolutionary, linear interpretation, but in a sort of what one might call a rupture or breakdown interpretation, where you emphasize the War of Independence and not the revolutionary aspects of the American experience. I find this particularly interesting myself because I grew up and was taught history in England until I was 21 and came here. And of course, I never heard the word American Revolution at all until I came to the United States. It was entirely the War of Independence. And this was not because of Marxism, as I say. It was because of what I would call a sort of classical liberal view, which I think also tends to de-emphasize, if you like, the intellectual construction, the originality involved in what happened in North America. Now, of course, there are certain conspiracies, I think, informal conspiracies, that also emphasize this view. The French really never liked Palmer's interpretation because it de-emphasizes the originality of the French Revolution. If there was a precursor to the French Revolution, then what happened this year, 200 years ago, is not so original. So the French, I think, have never been terribly interested in the Palmer interpretation, apart from Godeschaux is the only exception. And I think, as I say, the general run of, I would say, English historians who've had a dominant influence in many ways in the modernization of history in the recent years, one thinks of Lawrence Stone and people of this nature, social history, tends also to de-emphasize institutional changes, their importance, the importance of ideas. History of ideas has fallen on very poor times in universities in the last 20 years. So all these, I think, are an informal conspiracy in a sense that lead to a de-emphasis of really the importance of the period that we are talking about, and of the importance of intellectual, what I call intellectual construction. So there's no doubt that I think over the last 20 years, both in Latin America, mainly, I think, because there's been an enormous influence of Marxist penumbra, not necessarily Marxist in a crude sense, but a general framework for Marxist analysis that I think dominated most Latin American intellectuals over the last 20 years or so, if not more. And I think in the American Latin Americanists, because certain influence of Marxism, but mainly the Anal school, emphasis on social trends, emphasis on economic structures and so on. All this has again led to very, very little emphasis on constitutionalism, on ideas, on the Enlightenment, on all those elements which were so critical to an earlier interpretation of the importance of the origins of the United States in its institutional forms. It is quite extraordinary to me, and this is what Ken was referring to at the beginning, that just at the moment when history in its ironic way turns a wheel and we see the whole Soviet Union now struggling precisely with constitutional questions, one sees even more Eastern Europe struggling in a very direct way with constitutional questions. One sees the whole of Latin America returning to a tremendous emphasis on how do you form a state that A functions, that B guarantees individual liberties, you know, that is efficient, that and so on. I mean, these are all issues that are now back on the front burner, and you find it at a time when the scholarly literature is absolutely devoid of any help. I mean, there's really nothing that's come out in the last 20 or 30 years that helps. I was looking over the bibliography to see when the last book, for example, on the Enlightenment in Latin America was published. It was published in 1943. By the late Arthur Whitaker, some of you may be a great historian of Latin America, and that's the last book. There's been absolutely nothing since then, and this was a very preliminary, a very sort of, you know, brilliant overview, but there's been very little research since. So what are we lacking there? For we're lacking, I think, a sense of a politics that went on this period. We're lacking any good feel for what went into the intellectual construction of the new states. We're lacking any good comparative analysis of what I would call the instrumentalities of governance, that is, constitutions, and so on. So what I want to do, therefore, is as I say, having broached these broader issues, which I think is the context and importance of what we're talking about, to look a little bit in some detail at one specific case to show how rich and interesting this period is and what an enormous importance there is to the comparative study of it. But first I just want to make two general points about the Palmer thesis, because in general I think you'll see that my interpretation fits perhaps closer to him than it does to the more academistic one. But I think there is an important qualification to be made about the linear view, that is, the linear view between the Enlightenment and constitutionalism. Because there has been a lot of work recently on the impact of the Enlightenment on absolutist regimes in Europe in the 18th century, and this has been done particularly in Central and Eastern Europe. Mark Ryeff, the Russian historian, is perhaps the leading scholar in this area. And one has had quite a lot of work done on the southern, what's called the Southern European or Catholic Enlightenment. And Franco Venturi is one of the leading elements who's written on this, and I've also, and a couple of people in Spain have written on this topic. I think what is emerging is a somewhat more complex view of the Enlightenment. And I say this now because, as you'll see at the end, this comes together in a very interesting way at the end of my talk. There are very distinct differences. That is, that one should not assume that certain elements that are fundamental to our view of the Enlightenment, which is a positive, benign view in the North American circumstances, not necessarily the case in Southern Europe or Eastern Europe. In fact, Mark Ryeff has used the very, very dramatic phrase to describe how he views the Enlightenment in these states. He calls it the organization of a well-organized police state, which is hardly what we think of. In terms of the impact of the Enlightenment in North America or even in France or in Britain. What he means by that is that it was a rationalizing, utilitarian movement, which we all know, a rationalistic movement that came out of the Enlightenment. It put a huge emphasis on education, modernization of the education curriculum, particularly natural sciences, botany, all the physics, mathematics and so on coming in a modern way, the getting out of scholastic and religious and clerical influences in the curriculum. All these are characteristics of Southern and Northern and of Eastern Europe. But of course the object and economic development, of course, was also a very important part of it. That is, you rationalize society, you improve the education of people to the greater benefit of the economic development of the state. All these also apply to some degree to North America and into Western Europe. But the important difference is, and I think it's a critical one, is that these were all state centrally imposed notions. In other words, the Enlightened leadership in Southern Europe and Eastern Europe very much saw the state as being the guarantor of this more rational, modern, developed society. Very, very different from North America, and I think also, to some degree, Britain and France, in that the state was the enemy. In other words, you develop systems to control the state. Separation of powers, defense of individual liberties, defense of the press, elements like this. This all may sound very trite, but I think it's very important to say it very, very, very directly, because one should not, I think, assume, as I say, that the rationalizing, the Enlightenment elements necessarily lead to constitutionalism and the enshrinement of a constitution that, in effect, controls the state and does not give power to the state. This is extremely important, as I think you'll see in the course of later discussions on Latin America, because, of course, the influence that came into Latin America came from Southern Europe, came from the Bourbon reforms in Spain in the case of Spanish America, came from the Pombaline reforms in Portugal with respect to Brazil. These were classical cases of enlightened absolutism as opposed to what I would contrast enlightened constitutionalism. Quite different phenomena. So as I say, so much for generalizations. But what is very interesting is that in October 1786, Jefferson, who then, as you know, was the ambassador, the U.S. Representative in France, received a letter, a coded letter, from Montpellier, University of Montpellier in the south of France, signed only with a pseudonym Vendek. Never quite understood where Vendek came from, but it is interesting that about 2 years before the famous novel by Beckford was published, which was Vathek. I've always wondered whether Vendek was a... because he was very much involved with these people. But anyway, Jefferson established a safe channel for correspondence. And in a second letter that came through this secret channel, this Vendek declared himself. He says, "I am a Brazilian," and I'm quoting. I have the original here from the Jefferson papers, which is in France. But let me just translate the key parts here. You might like to. I'm quite interested to see that. He said he declared himself to be a Brazilian. He said, "Since the epoch of your glorious independence, the slavery in which my own country lies is rendered each day more insupportable. Brazilians," he said, "have decided to follow the example of North Americans to break the chains that bound them to Portugal. Nature made us inhabitants of the same continent," he told Mr. Jefferson, "and in consequences, to some degree, compatriots." Jefferson describes his meeting in a letter of May 4th, 1787, to John Jay. This is the period of the Articles of Confederation. So the correspondence was with the Secret Committee of Congress. And he gives a very interesting description here of his meeting. He says, this is to John Jay, as I say. He says, "My journey," he's writing from Marseille, "into this part of the country has procured me information that I take the liberty to communicate to Congress. In October last, I received a letter from Montpellier announcing that the writer was a foreigner and of matter of great consequence to communicate to me, and desired that I indicate a channel through which it might pass safely. I did so, and I received a second letter, the one that I'm circulating here. It says, "As by this time I had been advised to try the waters at X, I wrote to the gentleman of my design and that I should go off my road near Nîmes under the pretext of seeing the antiquities at that place, if he would meet me there. He met me, and the following is the sum of the information." He then goes on, detailed information on a Brazilian situation. And then he says in short, he says, "As to the question of revolution, there is but one mind in the country. They consider the North American Revolution as a precedent for theirs. They look to the United States as most likely to give them honest support, and for a variety of considerations of the strongest prejudices in our favor. They would want cannon, ammunition, ships, soldiers, and so on. Always understood that such service and furniture will be well paid for. They would want from us at all times corn, salt, and fish. So Portugal, being without either army or navy, could not attempt an invasion under 12 months. considering that what it would be composed of, it would be not much to be feared. And if it failed, they would probably never attempt again. As you see, a very very interesting secret meeting in Nîmes at the antiquities there. I've been in touch with some French historians, and I have a strong feeling, and I'm not sure, maybe some Jefferson scholars here know better than I about this. I cannot believe that the ambassador of the United States at this period would travel throughout France without being followed by spies from the French government. This is 2 years before the French Revolution, if you remember. And next time I go to Paris, I have to go to the secret police archives and see if apparently they're extremely rich. And I'd be very, very interested to see if somebody was actually, you know, following Jefferson right at this point. Jefferson was very cautious in what he said. He said, "I took care to impress on him that I had no authority to speak on this subject, and that I could only give my ideas as a single individual." What he said was that we were the United States, not in a condition to meddle nationally in any war, that we wished particularly to cultivate the friendship with Portugal, with which we had an advantageous commerce. I should point out Virginia in particular had a very advantageous commerce in grain and flour with Portugal at this time. And yet a successful revolution in Brazil would not be uninteresting to us, that prospects of lucre might possibly draw of individuals to their aid, and purer motives our officers, among them many who are excellent, and that our citizens, being free to leave of their country individually without the consent of their governments, again the period of the Articles of Confederation, are equally free to go to any other. He sent this on to Congress and asked for a reaction. What is interesting is I've been able to trace this on the Brazilian side, and a very accurate account of Jefferson's conversation reached Brazil within a year and a half. Maia traveled back to Rio de Janeiro and was in contact with a very significant plot that was concocted in the interior of Brazil, in the area of the gold and diamond mining area up in the mountains, in what is called Minas, the Minas Gerais, the general mines, one of the most important states of Brazil. It was then very important. It had some 20% of the total population of Brazil. It was the principal source of the royal fifth, which was the main income that came from Brazil to the Portuguese crown. The Minas conspiracy involved three major sections of the population. It involved the major intellectuals who were involved in local government, in other words, people involved in municipal government. It involved the local judges, the Portuguese appointed judges in the high court and in the fiscal organs of the local area. But very important, it involved the military forces, the military forces, and it involved a lot of the very large businessmen, the big investors in the mines, and the people who were involved in the trade, the trading of the commodities in and out of the interior. The plot was betrayed and discovered, but because of this, we have a very unique view of the thought processes of the books, of the discussion of these people. It strikes me as very curious historically that in sometimes failed plots tell you more historically than successful ones, because successful ones normally like to hide their origins for all sorts of reasons. History goes on in different ways and they don't want to remember what they said 3 or 4 years before. Here we have a very unique snapshot of exactly what was going on. And the confiscations, they confiscated their libraries. We have a good sense of their libraries. In the pocket of the principal conspirator at the time of his arrest was a copy, in French, of the Articles of Confederation and the Constitution of the State, with particular emphasis on the Constitution of 76 of the State of Virginia, annotated and discussed by the people. We can follow the discussion through in the interrogations. 3 or 4 years of interrogations took place. So we have a very, very good idea of the type of constitution. I come back to maybe wondering where constitution got in all this. A very good idea of the type of constitutional ideas that they had in 1789. The plot was 1789. This is just on the eve of the French Revolution. It's enormously influenced by the American Revolution. A few of the things I can that we know, putting together, piecing together what their proposals. The system of government was to be Republican. That alone is very significant, because if you think historically Brazil did not become a republic until 100 years ago this year, this is the centenary of the Brazilian Republic. This is 1789, 200 years ago this year. Monopolies were all to be abolished. In other words, they wanted to get out of the whole sort of mercantilist system. Manufactories were to be established. They were going to develop iron ore deposits. Factories, particularly gunpowder factories, were to be established. Freedom was to be granted to native-born slaves and mulattoes. This is an extraordinary radical decision for 1789. A university was to be founded, a very interesting idea, in the capital city. All women who produced a certain number of children were to receive a prize at the expense of the state. This is something these days would be the opposite, but with population explosion, but the notion was to encourage population. This, I think, is very similar to what Catherine did in Russia. I think there was some, and perhaps in Germany, I think there was some model for this. There was to be no standing army, which is a very interesting notion coming directly out of the American experience. All citizens instead, and this sounds very familiar, were to bear arms and when necessary serve in a national militia. Sounds very familiar. Parliaments were to be established in each town, subordinate to a supreme parliament in the capital. And for the first 3 years, the principal judge, the principal magistrate, was to rule, after which there would be annual elections. There were to be no distinctions or restrictions of dress. This is extremely important in the southern European context, because there was tremendous class distinctions associated with dress that people were allowed to. This was to be abolished. The elite was going to be obliged initially to wear locally manufactured products as a way of encouraging industry. But above all debtors to the royal treasury were to be pardoned. There's more I can say, but as you see, there's some fascinating linkages to the type of discussion that was going on in this Atlantic framework. Historians always say, well, how can you prove ideas, things in libraries affect people? It seems to me here you have a marvelous example where you actually have, you know what the book was, you know the connection with Jefferson, you know what the discussion was, you have the annotated book, and you have the result. It seems to me absolutely extraordinary historically, and rather unique that you can see this. But what happened? In other words, what I'm saying is that the American model, in the one case, one can look at it in great detail, was enormously important. They saw the North American model not only as an independence movement that was a model for theirs, and the references, of course, to the taxes and to the revenues reflected also very much what they thought had been some of the causes of the revolution in North America. But they're very influenced by what I call the intellectual construction of the North Americans in this case. But what happened? Why is it that later on this model didn't carry on? Why is it that Brazil, for example, and many of the other Latin American countries in the 1820s did not turn to the American model but to the European one? I think the timing is very important. And often, again, unfortunately, in history in recent years, one's had a turn away from chronology. One's had a notion that changes go on and on forever and you don't really need to look at details. Details are very, very important. This plot occurred in 1789. It was discovered, the arrests were made throughout 1790 and 91, exactly when the French Revolution was occurring. What is even more significant is that the impact of the French Revolution in America was the enormous slave uprising in Haiti. As you see, we have here in the Minas discussion a serious talk about the liberation of slaves. One has serious talk about incorporating mulattoes and so on, what in Brazilian terminology we call pardos, or brown people, that is mixed race, racial people born in the Americas, incorporating them into the society that was going to oppose Portugal. After 1792, particularly, I think that became absolutely impossible in the Americas, in societies that were plantation-based, where half the population was slave, and where a third of the rest of the population was mulatto. In other words, in a place like Brazil, only a third of the population was white. A place like Haiti, maybe 9% or 10% of the population was white. it's curious that you have a sort of certain naivete, in other words, among the elites in this part of the America, the Americas up until 1789, after 92. This is gone, and it shows itself very interestingly again in the case of Brazil, where one has another plot that took place in 1798 in Bahia. Now Bahia, unlike Minas, is on the coast. It's a sugar planting area. It's an area which was closest to Africa. It's still the most Africanized part of Brazil. And here in 1792, a plot was uncovered which involved a very, very different segment of the population. In Minas, we were talking about the elite. We were talking about people aware of what was going on in Europe. In Bahia, we were talking, the plot was among what might be called the urban proletariat to some degree, the urban shopkeepers. None of them white, all of them mulattoes or former slaves or ex-slaves. And here again we know exactly what they are thinking, because we have records, we have the documents that they wrote. Handwritten manifestos, what do they talk about? They talk about the Republican Bahian people, they talk about the detestable metropolitan yoke of Portugal. They say the clergy should be attacked. The clergy were very involved in the Minas conspiracy. So all citizens, I'm quoting, especially mulattoes and blacks, were told all are equal, there will be no differences, there will be freedom, equality, and fraternity. All black and brown slaves are to be freed so that there will be no slavery whatsoever. The happy time of our liberty, it says, is about to arrive, the time when all will be brothers, when all will be equal. They were looking to France, and they were looking to Haiti. Among the artifacts that were uncovered in the arrests was a small medallion of Christophe, one of the Haitian rulers. As I say, I could talk much more about this, but I think what you see is this counterplay going on in the Americas, which undermines, from the point of view of the elite, many of the optimistic and positive views that had come out of the American experience. Very quickly were seen to be quite dangerous in a social situation where you had such a tremendously imbalanced racial balance in the population, so that if you talked of fraternity and liberty, you had to realize that, you know, you were dealing with a population that was, as I say, 50% slave and 2/3 non-white. This had not been thought about prior to 1789, after 1789, because of the Haitian slave revolt, because of the killing of the whites, because of the reaction in France and so on to all this. That situation changed very dramatically. So I think looking at what I call Atlantic America, that is plantation America, export-oriented America, which includes really the whole of the southern Atlantic coastline, through the Caribbean, up, I suppose, to some degree into North America. You had a very, very different and more conservative, more cautious attitude towards constitutional reform, to what you could include within it, to what type of institutional structures you could play with, because there was a real risk you were playing with fire in these circumstances. Now, the very curious thing, and I just to come to the end of this, I don't want to talk for too long, is that this brought together, in the Southern European and South American context, those two lines of the Enlightenment, which I said had diverged. In other words, the constitutional line and the sort of statist line. And the rulers, particularly in Spain, Charles III, and in Portugal, Pombal and his successors, very enlightened people, children of the Enlightenment, reacted to this situation as a opportunity, not as a danger to them. In other words, instead of reacting in a way that sought to close all the doors, they saw this as a way in which they could link the colonial elites closely to the elites in the metropolis. And this went, I think, furthest in Brazil, because the peculiar chronology of the failure of the Republican, American, North American influence experiment, in the Venus conspiracy, the threat from below revealed by the buy-in conspiracy, provided a sort of push factor for the elites in Brazil particularly, and I think this is true in the Caribbean, it's certainly true in Cuba also later, a push into the embrace of an enlightened metropolitan elite. What they did was incorporate the leading Brazilians into the formation of government policy to devise some sort of a more equitable relationship between the metropolis and the colony. In a sense, looking towards a new form that went beyond a purely colonial and metropolitan relationship. This came to fruition in the case of Brazil in 1807, 1808, when the court of Portugal, the government of Portugal, moved to Brazil. This was partly forced by the Napoleonic situation, but it was also planned, and there had been 5 or 6 years of planning in this, and a recognition by an important part of the elite that the future was no longer in Europe. The future was in the Americas. And in the Americas, the elite was responsive to this for the reasons that I've described. There's a very curious link here to where we are, and that is that the new kingdom, as it was set up, Kingdom of Brazil, the Algarves, and Portugal, based in Rio de Janeiro, appointed as its first minister to Washington, just the newly, I mean, very little there, but Washington just being constructed, an extraordinary Enlightenment character called Abbe Correa, C-O-R-R-I-E-A, Correa. He was a man in his 60s at this time. He had been a young man who had been sent to Italy in the 1740s and 50s. He'd been a student of one of the great figures of the Italian and Catholic Enlightenment, Abbe Genovese, who was one of the great educational reformers and natural historians, naturalists of the 18th century. Naples, you remember, very important for Spanish America. Naples was where Carlos III, Charles III, had been king prior to becoming king of Spain. It was where many of the Enlightenment absolutist experimentation had taken place in Italy, in southern Italy, which was then implemented in Spain. As I say, Abbe Correa, one of the brightest students of Genovese. He then went back to Portugal. He was responsible for the formation of the Academy of Sciences. Academy of Sciences was the core. Academy of Sciences set up in 78, 79, where these young Brazilian leaders that had been involved in the plot were incorporated into the formation of imperial policy. This was the Academy of Sciences became the core for the reformulation of this notion of there being an American monarchy, an American enlightened monarchy in Brazil. He then went to London. He was a member of the Royal Society. He was there 5 or 6 years. He went to Paris. He was one of the great inspirers behind the formation of the Jardin des Plantes. Was a friend of Humboldt, was a friend of Lafayette. He came to America in 1812. With letters of introduction to Jefferson from, among others, von Humboldt and Lafayette and the French Lumière, who was the head of the Jardin des Plantes, the great natural historian of natural philosopher in France. He became a very intimate friend of Jefferson. And in 1816, he was appointed the Minister Plenipotentiary for the new Brazilian-Portuguese Empire in Washington. So here you have one of these extraordinarily, what I call the tissues of relationship, from Jefferson's interest in Brazil as a result of this meeting with this young student secretly in Nîmes, with this great character coming out of the Catholic Enlightenment, an abbe of all things. I mean, one's prejudices about the Enlightenment, when you look at the facts, fall. I mean, here is an old Catholic priest who is totally anti-clerical, who is a great friend of Jefferson. And who is one of the discussants with Jefferson in his letters particularly on the University of Virginia, on the formation of the University of Virginia. And it's interesting to me how this educational element, which is so critical to both enlightenments, comes together in this very interesting way here. This is how Jefferson described Correa. He says, "Mr. Correa, a gentleman from Portugal, of the first order of science, being without exception the most learned man I have met with in any country, modest, good-humored, familiar, plain as a country farmer, he becomes a favorite of everyone with whom he becomes acquainted. He speaks English very well." Correa, incidentally, was quite important in the formation of the Neutrality Act, discussing with Monroe in 1817, but I think his most interesting here is their discussion on the plans for the formation of the University of Virginia. And Jefferson again is talking about this. He says, "Mr. Correa's approbation of the plan and principles of our university flatters me more than that of all other eulogists, because no other could be put in a line with him in science in the comprehensive scope of his mind." They have tremendous discussions of the particularly on the natural history side, in terms of recruitment of professors, and so on. And there's one marvelous exchange here that I can't resist reading a bit of to you. And I apologize in advance for any New Englanders here, but they're discussing the appointment of professors, and Jefferson's asking advice on a couple of people who have been vetoed, or at least questions have been raised about their sobriety. And if only you've been on tenure committees or foundations, you know the type of innuendos that are leveled against people, and very often you can't find out whether they're true or not. And Jefferson writes a very private letter saying, "This is the most secret letter I've ever written, but Mr. Cooper has been said to be a drunkard, and I would like to know if this is the case or not." So Correa writes back and he says, "My anxiety about the ultimate success of a university is not quite so much allayed. I have studied with some degree of attention the literary seminaries of America." And he had indeed, he'd visited all the universities and liberal arts colleges from New England down through the Deep South in this period. And he says that I've remarked the diseases to which they are liable in their beginnings, and under which most of them lead afterwards to lingering existence. One of the most pernicious is the mediocrity of views in a great number of people, and the mediocrity of science in those that aspire to be instituted." So I think he means as instructors.
Can you stop for just a minute while she turns?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Go back a line or two. This is too precious not to get. Go back a line or two.
Yes, I've studied with a great of science in those that would aspire to be instituted, so as I think he means instructors, and who generally, by the help of others, obtain their wishes. Thank God, the first of these infirmities has now no place in Virginia among the acting gentlemen. The second I have seen with my own eyes that prevail in America almost everywhere. Immediately, as a seminary of learning is instituted, people of great and contagious mediocrity, chiefly New England, squatting, and the seminaries become rickety in a point of science. It is not that those states are deficient in great men of knowledge, but these they keep at home. Anyway, he said, mediocrity in all shapes is anywhere naturally and strongly alive. They keep together and help one another by instinct. And then he says, "I take the liberty of speaking my sentiments to you so freely, being sure that you will not be offended at it, knowing that you do the hearty interest I take in your great state school. In my eyes, it is an institution that not only can ensure for the future the high standing of your state and union, but by raising emulation, accelerate the progress of knowledge in other states. Virginia, by its central situation, size, resources, and above all the character of its white population, is and will always be, in your continent, what France is to Europe." So I think there are a few better ways of coming back. So let me just sum up by saying I think, as you see, generalizations have some truth in them, but there's also a lot of specification that needs to be done, and I think it can be done. And as I say, in one small part of the Atlantic world, I think one can see here these extraordinary personal connections we're not speculating about, connections that are all documented between people, between our peers, that lead into, I think, what I would call, you know, the atmosphere that led to the type of constructions of constitutions and discussions in the government, discussions of what went into the formation of the state, which I think are quite critical to understand, both the different So this is a very dramatic difference. So I think the reconstruction of the problem in Spanish and is much more complicated than it was. And this shows, I think we were talking yesterday and we were saying that, you know, how extraordinary it is in Brazil, we've never seen that revolution. It's a violent tradition to many in Spanish. I think a lot of that goes back to this, this continuities which come out of, I think, this historical experience. The other thing perhaps I should have stressed more, is that I think that one of the results of the compromise, if you like, or undermining of the North American model, which I think did occur in the 1970s, is that it was substituted very much by a French model, but it was a very peculiar French model. It wasn't the French revolutionary model, it was very much the Napoleonic model. So that you had the leaders of almost all the liberation movements very much of the characters and his military characters. So the military, from the very early stage of Spanish America, had a much more powerful place within, real place within the power structure than they had certainly in North America and certainly in Brazil. So whatever the institutional structure, there was always that, you know, that element of power that would interfere with the upset, with the military. So this, I think, led to bit of the notion that is powerful in the literature of institutional structures on both sides, for manipulations by the shooters or powerful vested interests or the military's need to be a powerful military jurisdiction. And if there are, you know, there's obviously some truth to that. What is interesting then, I think, is that the period you're talking about, mainly, I think, would be, say, the 50s, the 1850s onwards, where you do begin a slow beginning of European. Reaching a large element, never on the scale of North America, but certainly quite a large immigration in the southern continent, southern Brazil, from the 1890s,
1880s.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. And then you get a revival of the American model, which is mentioned. And I think this is something which I'm sure will come out in future discussions, and you get a very powerful impact of the American model. That model is undermined again by a number of reasons. I think partly American power is one of these. America, North America, I mean, the United States, rather than being one among the hemispheric powers, not the dominant power, becomes the dominant power by the 1860s. And therefore, particularly in Central America, Mexico is seen as a threat. And the model is not attractive for that reason. But you've also got experimentation in England. This century, where you have a whole series of new models coming in, which are a derivative of the tensions of the 1920s and 30s. So you have the corporatist constitutional models, which all countries in Latin America suffer, still suffer from. And that's certainly true in Brazil, I think it's true in Argentina, it's true in some of the institutional mechanisms in Chile. Now, what is very exciting about the current situation is we are getting, again, all these issues are up for grabs again. There's a lot of constitution making going on now. And coinciding with a time when the other model, which would be the Soviet model, for
in particular for what you mentioned, because of the imperial tradition. And I remember one reflection from this very illustrious writer in Latin America, Jacques Lambert, the French historian and political scientist, saying that the main tragedy of Latin America is that there is a wide gap between the social reality and the political institutions. And I think that this gap, although it's true for all of Latin America, is true for countries other than Brazil. Because in Brazil, you mentioned this difference, this very important, between enlightenment, absolutism, and enlightenment constitution. I think that Brazil was very clever, Brazil is really very clever to choose this enlightenment absolutism, which was more alien to the social basis and to the political and historical decision. Whereas the rest of Latin America tried to jump to this enlightenment constitution, because it was so far ahead. Was so different from the reality that we really created the gulf between social reality and political political reality. But on the other hand, I don't know if you wish to comment on the fact that Brazil shares with the rest of Latin America some things inherited from Portuguese rule, namely the failure to develop the institution of self-government. Like in the rest of Spanish America, the Cabildo never developed, and also the lack perhaps of independent institution that in Brazil were very easily co-opted into a corporatist model. So the thrust of my question is to drill more on the how exceptional is Brazil and what does it have in common with the rest of Latin American nations.
I know this is always a great problem, is the exception, but the problem then is everything is exceptional. You see, this is the problem. And to reach some comparative look, one has to see what is different or what is similar. And that's why I go back to the history. I think what I'm trying to do is to develop the other side of the Spanish-American side, which is also quite interesting in a lot of contexts. And in fact, I'm not sure about it. It's a tremendous question. I think that one there is an almost an unquestioned assumption that there is a social conditions for democracy. But then, if you look back, and then you see the social differentiation, even in the United States, as part of the independence movements, it's not necessarily the case. I mean, there's enormous social big question. I don't know the answer to that. It's one of the key questions. I mean, are there
So those were all involved. The slave and free mulatto, or the mulatto and slave liberation, again in Brazilian historical style, it was dismissed as the radical conscience of which the conservative in Brazilian. But of course, in the Puritan, as you say, I agree with you, it's extremely radical. And the discussion came out of the discussion of the forces needed. Fortunately, with appeal to slaves. completely dominated by the system of Hatian.
Yeah. Except you remember that the most, the strongest support for Spanish retention of the return of Spain was in the some parts of Mexico. So I should have perhaps defined more carefully about Latin America. I contrast the Atlantic America to the Andean America, which I think are the strongly Indian influenced, dominant Indian societies. A lot of people are Indian participants. And the Atlantic is being exported to sugar, coffee, cotton, you know, these type of commodities that flow into the Atlantic commercial system. And basically African slave worked circumstances. I mean, you have to remember that Buenos Aires had a slave population, had a black population in the 1830s, 1840s, 1850s, something like 55% of the population. You don't think of that now, but it's disappeared. Mexico had a large black population, which also disappeared. So, you know, historically things change. But, so I would sort of, my Atlantic America runs basically from Buenos Aires, I suppose, to Maryland. This is the Atlantic seaboard coast. And this is why Haiti, for all those, Haiti was the great fear. I mean, what Haiti did, not because Haiti itself represented a threat, but it showed, you know, the only great success we've seen in modern history. It absolutely terrified. However enlightened the slave owner was,
at that time the Indians were not considered a threat, but paradoxically, two centuries later,
yes,
shining path in Peru has been able to manipulate the Indians to become a real threat.
No, but I think Peru is a fascinating case because the Indian, a huge upheaval of class, took a Camargo, came very close to success. One of the fascinating things here in the Jefferson correspondence is he says that our information at the time was extremely partial, and we didn't quite believe the scale of the uprising. I mean, now on very good authority, on paraphrasing, we know that it was a very large uprising, and that had indeed, you know, 5,000 American intervention forces, I mean, Gaines' words are not his, but that type of 5,000 men being put ashore, as the way he put it, this might have, this would have ended Spain's control. I think that's true. I think we know that. And the curious thing about Peru is that you had the failed Indian uprising prior to, you know, the impact of the American Revolution, the constitutional experimentation, and prior to the type of revolution you had in Mexico at the time of independence. So you never got the sort of integrated society to some degree that I think Mexico actually has to do with that. So the timing, if you're looking at this, the chronology, very, very important. Recently, I think historians have not looked at chronology. I mean, they've tended to homogenize it. And if you do that, you miss some of the explanation. Why certain things, I was at the beginning, why do certain things take hold? You know, certain times, certain models take hold and they don't take hold again. It's very important. If ever you go, I mean, if you've been to Brazil, you know those are